This is Scott Becker with the Becker Private Equity Podcast, the Scott Becker Private Equity Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by long-term investor and brilliant leader, Matt Kaufman. Matt's the managing partner and the founder of Validor Capital. He's going to talk to us about Validor, what he sees, what he's interested in, what he's most excited about this year, and a little bit more. Matt, can you take a second and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Validor Capital?
Yeah, sure, Scott. Thank you for having me. I'm Matt Kaufman, managing partner at Validor Capital. Validor was founded in 2012 and operates as an independent sponsor focused on lower middle market family or founder-owned industrial, manufacturing, and service companies. We consider ourselves operationally focused. I know that term gets thrown around a lot out there, and it certainly, is a continuum, and we fall somewhere within that. But, my two partners both come from industry, and, while I took a more traditional private equity path, having in my career walked literally, hundreds of factory floors and implementing, numerous projects from major capital investments for growth to lean to automation to facility rationalizations, I think I know at least enough to be dangerous as well. We've closed 7 transactions since our founding, and I have a particular focus on niche manufacturing businesses. So, those companies addressing markets that may be smaller than, let's say, 10 figures or $1 billion, but also companies that play a meaningful role in those markets. We also seek out companies where we feel we can be collaborative value-added partners. And so we're not day-to-day in any of our businesses, but we do want to roll up our sleeves and use, our collective experiences and networks to assist management teams in achieving their goals.
Magnificent. And let me ask you a question. Like this year, I mean, what a fascinating time to be a niche manufacturer. What are some of the issues you're seeing in the world you're in? And then I want to ask you about what was it like starting as an independent sponsor? Is it nerve-wracking? Was it exciting? Did you have a deal under wraps when you started to get going? That must have been very stressful and exciting. Let's start with that question, starting as an independent sponsor.
Sure. So, short answer is yes, it was nerve-wracking for sure. I mean, I was going off on my own and I had a thesis. I'm a planner, so I did my homework, I did my diligence. I lined up what I thought at the time and ended up being what I was my investor base. And so, I had a lot of confidence in myself in terms of execution, but I was like, well, will people invest with me? And for me, I came from private equity and I lived in, New York for 15 plus years. And so I had a really good network there. And what I did was really, go to folks with a white paper and said, hey, this is what I've done. This is what I want to do. And if I bring you this type of deal, or do you have any interest? Do you have modest interest? Do you have a lot of interest? And I basically found, half a dozen to a dozen people who, said I have a lot of interest. And that's what gave me the confidence.
And were those mostly sort of high net worth individuals, family offices when you first got started? Were they pension funds? Were they insurance companies? Who are the first sort of investors in your independent sponsor business? And are they the same people or the same sort of types of investors today?
So my investors, which were those that I mentioned and continue to be, are largely high net worth individuals. In some instances, I don't know everything about, these folks, but could they be family offices, single family offices? They certainly can, but they're really not organized that way. And because almost all of them I knew for 10 plus years, you know, I'm dealing with the person. I'm not. It's not like they have professionals managing their money, and you know, I'm dealing directly with them. And because they're not in all cases, but more or less, in the financial industry, they kind of get it. Yeah, they get what I'm doing, and they make quick decisions. So it was sort of high net worth, and those investors from my first deal have continued through all my deals, and along the way I've added some investors, and so of a similar ilk to my investors I originally had. So, you know, that's how I've been growing. At any given time I may need to expand that group. I may need to go to a more institutional investor. It's all going to depend on kind of the deals I'm doing and the velocity of those deals and the size of those deals. But, you know, I've been very happy with the way we're set up now, and the investor group, and they're supportive, and they just understand kind of the business and the nature of the business and what we're trying to do.
So let me ask you, I mean, two or three questions. It's a million times easier to go back to those investors when they've had success with you on the early investments. If they've done well early, much easier to keep going back to them, right? And very hard to go back to them if you've not had success with them.
That is no doubt correct. So thankfully, my first deal out of the box was very successful. So,
right.
You know, knock on wood.
So the raise and the phone calls get a lot easier on deals 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. If you've had success on deals 1, 2, 3, I mean, just much people are like, oh my God, yes, can I put some money with you on this next deal? You know, I mean, it's obviously looking at the diligence, but they're really counting on you for more of the diligence than themselves. So that's one thing. I mean, the raise must get so much easier. And then what do you ever think about, and more independent sponsors, I mean, it sounds like you've got a lovely situation because you're not holding hundreds of millions of capital that you have to worry about every day deploying in a very challenging world. Rather, you do deal by deal, independent sponsor. Many independent sponsors go back and forth, at least have thought someday that they want to be the next Blackstone or they want to have committed capital funds. How do you look at that issue, and how do you think about that issue of independent sponsor versus having a committed capital fund versus a responsibility and the lift of having a committed capital fund versus what you do now? How do you sort of balance those thoughts in looking at what you do?
Yeah, sure. Look, I'm like probably many independent sponsors, as you mentioned, there are moments where I think about raising a fund, think about creating a large institution, that could survive certainly well past my involvement. And that happens, but you know, most days I kind of look at what I've got here in Valador and think it, you know, I got a pretty good thing going, and just how complicated do I want my life to be? It's almost that simple. I don't have all those requirements and obligations that you have when you have a fund. And therefore I don't need to have a whole middle office and back office and investor relations groups and all these things, which are really not about really doing deals and learning about businesses and investing in businesses, which is what I like. I don't like all that other stuff.
I don't blame you. I think it's just a fascinating discussion because it's hard for many people to make that decision. This is what I love doing. This is what I'm good at. I like to operate. I like to do deals. Oh my goodness. I don't want all this back office, all the headaches that come with this. I don't want 100 employees. I just don't want that. But it's hard sometimes not to let ego or security get the better of one and chase that, especially when you see this whole mix of people, it's independent sponsors doing very well, and then people with committed capital funds doing very well, and it just is a different type of model. And so it's a fascinating just constant assessment as to what somebody wants, and knowing what they want is probably the greatest gift of all, quite frankly. Different question for you. What manufacturing, what issues are you seeing in the manufacturing world today? I mean, is it a good time to be an investor in niche manufacturing, a bad time, or how do you look at some of those issues?
Well, look, I think it's a great time, but it's a volatile time. And so, you know, you certainly, you know, need to probably be more engaged than really I can ever imagine in my career. You know, certainly 2008, 2009 was an interesting time as well, but that was more of a batten down the hatches, you know, like it was all down, you know, everything was going down. Now you have just more volatility up and down. And so what's driving that, right, is what we're all hearing about. It's raw material prices. It's unstable supply chains. I mean, these are major issues that every business, you know, certainly manufacturing is dealing with, like, oh my, what if we run out of supply? Oh my, our costs went up 30% in 2 months. Like, and we can't push through price increases like quick because the way we sell. That's both exciting and it's interesting and it's opportunity, but it's also risk. And so, you know, the other thing I would say is just the finding and attracting and retaining human capital. And that's not just folks that work on factory floors, which, you know, is more challenging than, you know, ever. It's all the way up the chain and senior management. It's just harder to do that. And so, you know, it's exciting for us because, right, it's exciting. It's opportunity. It's you know, daily, weekly kind of check-ins and what's going on and trying to make sure we're pivoting, you know, when we need to. But yeah, and so from our standpoint, it's a great time. I think, you know, the other challenging part about investing now, as opposed to, you know, owning the business. If you own the business, you're in it. You're managing all these things. Is if you're investing, right, you have to from the outside in kind of figure out what, you know, what the all these issues are for the company you're looking at. That's sometimes, you know, hard to do. It takes time. It takes engagement with management teams. And you know, what you've also seen is these companies coming out to market, you know, they'd either have this huge COVID bump, right? So their EBITDA has sometimes doubled or more in during COVID and, right. And they're being sold saying, look, this is sustainable. And your job.
Right. And you have to look at what is the real normalized earnings? What do those look like going forward? I mean, I'm intimately familiar with exactly the issue you're talking about. Is what is they've had this bump, it looks fantastic, but are those real or are those Memorex, and what do they look like going forward? 100%.
Yeah, and sometimes we look at things and our determination is, you know what, we're not sure we can figure out what the normalized is. So do we want to get involved in something where we're going to spend 2 months time and a lot of money and end up getting into a fight with a seller over what's normalized or not. And you know, not to say we're not
right.
pursuing deals that have that, but we're being careful.
But they think real EBITDA is $9 million a year. You think real EBITDA, if they dare to tell, might be $6 million a year. But they're of course going to want to price off a nine. You want to price off somewhere between six and nine, and very challenging to come to actual terms if there's a real disagreement as to what normalized earnings look like, or at least in the ballpark, particularly if you don't see crazy growth coming forward, that's going to make up for any errors that are made on that front end. It's fascinating.
Exactly. And some people are bridging that with earnouts in other ways. But look, again, for us, small team, right, we just can't spend months on something where you're hoping you can bridge it, you know, at the 11th hour, you know, so it's a challenge. And so look, this COVID bump's got to go away eventually, because it's either going to be, you know, the truth's going to come out. It's either not real or it was real, or, you know, and so, you know, as we go forward here, you know, I think that challenge will start to mitigate, but you know, it's still something we see every day.
Right. Well, a better sense of it by midway through 2022 or the end of 2022, what real earnings look like absent a pandemic or absent sort of things moving to virtual versus not virtual and some of the savings or not savings or whatever it might be. Fascinating,
right.
Matt. Ann Arbor versus Boca Raton, what's a better place to live?
Oh, Ann Arbor versus... Wow. I think it depends on I hate to say it, but your age. certainly in your 20s, Ann Arbor, no doubt. for me. I got three kids and a family, and we love it. We love Boca Raton. So, Ann Arbor, I love Ann Arbor and love to spend time there.
God bless. I want to thank you for joining us. I know I have a daughter who went to Michigan. I'm not a Michigan fan. I do think at some point Michigan will beat Ohio State again, but I don't know what decade that will be, but we will see. Matt, it is in all seriousness, it is just a pleasure to visit with you and hear your story and what you've done with Valador Capital, what your team has done. Just absolutely magnificent. Thank you so much for taking the time to visit with us today.
Scott, thank you as well.